Blog Talk.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to CrimeWire. An elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there. On top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show tonight. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. I'm Donna Pendergast, filling in for Susan. Manning the board for us tonight is our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Delilah Jones of Imagine Publicity is pinch-hitting for Denny Griffin. Delilah, why don't you take it away by introducing our first case?
All right. Welcome, everyone. The first case that we're going to be discussing tonight is Hassani Campbell, and I'm just going to give you a little background on the case. Hassani Campbell was born on September 24, 2003, in San Francisco, California. He was born with cerebral palsy, as was his mother. Because of the abuse he suffered at the hands of his parents, he was removed from his home and placed in foster care. Social services approached his biological aunt, Jennifer Campbell, and her boyfriend, Louis Ross, to adopt Hassani and his sister, Aliyah. The four of them moved to 5997 Roxy Terrace in Fremont, California. According to Ross, on August 10, 2009, he parked his car in the back parking lot behind Jennifer's place of employment, a shoe store in Rock Ridge. Ross claims he then took the younger child, Aliyah, inside the store, and when he went back outside to get Hassani, he was no longer in the vehicle. Reportedly, there was domestic violence in the household, and Ross threatened to abandon Hassani at the BART station, which is documented on a text message he sent to Jennifer, and admitted that he did not want to raise a disabled child. It's believed that Hassani, who was 3 feet tall and weighed 40 pounds, had actually been killed in the house by Ross and that the kidnapping was bogus. His body has never been found. Jennifer Campbell, who was pregnant at the time, refused to take a polygraph, and Ross failed two of them. They were arrested but later released by Alameda County Deputy DA Tom Rogers for lack of sufficient evidence. Jennifer Campbell moved to Arizona with her new daughter and lives with Ross's aunt. Louis Ross is now living in Maryland and was named as person of interest on August 10, 2010. During a press conference, police stated that Hassani met with foul play at the hands of Louis Ross. Joining us tonight to discuss the case is Robin Weber, spokesperson and advisor to Citizens for the Lost, which was established after Hassani's mysterious disappearance. And also joining us is Jean Cervantes from Citizens Against Homicide. Welcome, Robin. Welcome, Jean. Can you elaborate any more on the story for our listeners, Robin?
Yes. According to Deputy Chief at the time, Howard Jordan, who was the acting deputy of the Oakland Police Department, within a day they had realized that Hassani Campbell had never been in the car with Louis Ross and his younger sister, Aliyah. cadaver dogs did not pick up Hassani's scent at all. There was also problems, as you can have mentioned, that in the household there was domestic violence and that Jennifer Campbell had been threatened with a sword, supposedly by Ross, and that they had met on the Internet. Ross was $400,000 in debt and was obviously looking for a woman to support him. He was a nursing student at one of the local colleges. He boasted on television that he was becoming a doctor because he was trying to solve the cure for cerebral palsy. Within 8 months of social services approaching Jennifer Campbell, who was basically a battered woman, even though she had a degree in psychology from Berkeley, Lewis Ross had begun to complain that he did not want to take care of Hassani. There was more than one threat. He also complained to the police when he was arrested and given the polygraph that he had misgivings about taking care of a developmentally retarded. The child was not retarded. He was actually quite bright. He was a graduate of the John McLaren School in San Francisco. He did very well in school. He was learning to read. He was learning to write. He was very, very close to his sister and very, very, very affectionate. But when the police realized that the child had never been in the car that day of the reported phony abduction, they acquired a search warrant at 5:45 a.m., signed by Judge Stable. The detective on the beat that time, was Ross State. Actually, his name is Ross Tisdale. The case was then turned over to Acting Lieutenant Gus Galindo, who's an expert in child homicide. They searched the house in Fremont, and Lewis Ross put on a lot of crocodile tears, but he never really cried. Jennifer Campbell seemed to be hysterical, but she did refuse to take a polygraph, and she always seemed to defer to Lewis Ross. At first, they practiced, I guess, going through the rituals of vigils that was led by Sherry Lynn Miller, who was very active in the Sandra Cantu case. After a while, they put up a website with very strange pictures of Hassani and Aaliyah that were taken previously 2 years before, even before Jennifer Campbell had been approached by social services. It's obviously...
Robin, let me just, this is Kim. Let me just jump in here real quick. Who put up the website with the strange pictures? Was that Jennifer and Lewis?
Yes.
Oh.
Lewis had worked for a computer company. The pictures were over 2 years old. There were very few current pictures. And there was also no updates on the search for the child or any real interest.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's at www.findhassani.com. There were never any updates. They didn't participate in most of the vigils. And when people tried to gather outside the house to put flyers on telephone poles, Lewis Ross opened up the window and ordered some profanities at these young volunteers and told them to get out of his yard because they were bothering him. So there was very little participation.
Robin, let me ask you this. You've mentioned that there were some text messages that were sent that referred to Hassani. And can you tell our listeners a little bit more about those text messages? Was it ever determined when those messages were sent and
yes.
exactly what they said about the child?
It was sent July 31st, 2009, exactly 10 days before the child disappeared. He was having a fight with Jennifer Campbell, and I cannot use the language that he used. They were deleted because of profanity. He said, "I'm abandoning Hassani. It's your responsibility to take care of him. I will not take care of him anymore. I am leaving him at the BART station," so you can use the F word, I'm sorry to say, several times, "so you can take care of him. I want nothing more to do with him."
So he basically indicated in this text message 10 days before Hassani ever disappeared that he was having a real issue with being involved in caring for this child.
Yes. He only seemed to favor Aaliyah, who was the little sister, who is not disabled. Cerebral palsy runs in the family. There's another aunt, Trinity. She also has palsy. So out of this entire family group, Hassani's mother, Hassani, and his aunt Trinity had palsy.
And obviously,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
He obviously was a ladies' man, very smooth, very cunning. I've seen his website. It was a chat room where he was looking to meet women.
Well, you say he, you're referring to Lewis Ross.
Yes.
Okay. Well, just so our listeners are clear on all this, Hassani was a foster child, as I understand it, of Jennifer Campbell. He was actually born to her sister.
Yes,
and
Tamika
there was
Campbell.
Okay, and there were problems in that household. I believe the sister had some drug problems.
She had cerebral palsy, mental problems, and was had substance abuse and was unable to feed or to take care of Hassani. He supposedly just sat in a diaper all day long and was totally neglected. And his father, Ronald Hughes, had been arrested for a sexual battery and was also a substance abuser and a panhandler.
So
they became wards of the state of California. The state sued them, and the city of San Francisco took the children away and put both children separately in foster care for 2 to 3 years. Aaliyah was not born until, I would say, 18 months later. But Hassani was removed. Aaliyah was not born. And he did very well in his foster care home with another child who had palsy, and he attended the John McLaren School in San Francisco, where he did a very, very, very cooperative disability program to prepare him for kindergarten.
And how did he end up with Jennifer Campbell? Was she his foster mother?
She was his biological aunt. She was his legal guardian, and I guess
Robin,
was DSS
aware of the domestic violence problems between Jennifer and Lewis Ross before Hassani was placed there?
I don't really have any access to any information. There were numerous visits because of his medical condition. Supposedly Jennifer Campbell was very diligent about taking him for all his medical appointments. The home was clean. The child was being read to. He had a beautiful room. There's a heartbreaking video on YouTube describing Hassani's room, showing him do a puzzle. And it was just a heartbreaking situation because they basically, I guess, preferred the child that was well, Aaliyah. Lewis Ross did not want to have anything to do with Hassani. According to Tom Rogers, who's Deputy District Attorney of Alameda County, he had expressed hatred towards Hassani during his interrogation.
And let me ask you this, Robin. You indicated that the professed story is that the last time Hassani was seen was in the car outside of a shoe store where Jennifer Campbell worked.
No one ever saw him.
Well,
no one has ever seen him, or the cadaver dogs never picked up a scent. The only known sighting of him was on August 6, 2009, in a Walmart in Fremont.
Okay. Well, that was my question. So the last time Hassani was seen was not in some car outside of a shoe store, but was seen
never
in
was
a Walmart.
Seen. Never was seen, and the cadaver dogs never picked up a scent. The police have hypothesized that Hassani was murdered in the house by Ross when Jennifer Campbell was at work. Ross had two BMWs. For a man who has $400,000 in debt, he obviously had very expensive tastes. He had a white BMW. The police know that the body, after Hassani was either strangled or suffocated, the body was removed in the white BMW. And the white BMW was eventually... What? I'm sorry?
I said, if the police indicated to you how they know that?
I had approached the police when I saw in the newspaper, I think it was the San Francisco Chronicle, that the white BMW had been impounded when Jennifer Campbell and Lewis Ross were forced to leave the house in Fremont. The neighbors were very upset about the situation. They felt uneasy. The landlord refused to renew the lease, and the white BMW was seen being removed and impounded by the police. It was the gray BMW was not impounded.
I have a question for Donna as a prosecutor. Donna, if these people were suspects and they said, you know, they were arrested, they say there wasn't enough evidence to hold them, why would they be allowed to leave the state? Is that abnormal or is it the way it goes?
No, once they're released, I mean, if there's not enough evidence to hold them, you have nothing you can do to put any kind of strings or tether on them. Either they're arrested or they're not. If they're arrested, sometimes they can be released on a tether, but that's after they've been charged and after it's been deemed that they're not a threat to the public, that, you know, they are eligible to be released on bond. But, you know, if they've been released for the reason that, you know, there's insufficient evidence to hold them, then there's nothing you can do to control their movement. They're free to come and go as they please.
Would it be difficult to get them back into custody if evidence arose?
No, that's not a problem. In most states, we have what's called, you know, the Uniform Extradition Act, where, you know, once we get a warrant, we arrest them there. They have to go through a formal court proceeding where, you know, the judge in the state where they've been caught asks them, are they willing to waive extradition back to the state that's requesting them, which in this case would be California. But really, it's only a formality. If they don't agree to be extradited, then there'll be a hearing in the state where they've been apprehended. But the only things that really have to be proven at that hearing are that you've got the right person. I mean, on some occasions, you get John Smith who's saying, I'm not the right John Smith, and they'll hold a hearing and do fingerprint comparisons and things of that nature. And, you know, if it's not the right person, then he doesn't get, you know, sent back to the state who's requesting him. But, you know, in 99% of the cases, you know, the defense attorney who's appointed for the individual goes in and says, look, the bottom line is you're going back one way or the other. You can delay this for a month or so and we can have hearings, but you are so-and-so and it's going to be proven, so you might as well just make this easy and go back. So it's rare for an extradition to, I mean, they posture sometimes at the beginning, like I'm not waiving it. But once they learn the facts of life, in most cases, you know, they go back willingly, or I should say at least go back without a fight.
I also wanted to add that there's a $75,000 reward. For any information about Lewis Ross, he was named the person of interest on August 10th, 2010, during a press conference that was covered uniformly throughout the state of California.
And Robin, I want to ask you, and Vito, I know you want to chime in here, but Robin, you indicated that there's a $75,000 reward. Where is that reward coming from?
Three counties in the state of California.
The counties are actually putting up the money?
Yes, three counties. San Francisco under Mayor Gavin Newsom and the Alameda County, and there's a third county.
My understanding, Robin, was that there was additional
money
coming from corporations, and or am I mistaken?
Yes, there were local merchants in the area, like a Chevrolet dealer. There were several vigils. There were several raffles. There were various charitable events that were attended. Enormous media turnout, because it turned out to be a very famous case.
And the total came to $75,000.
Yes, which is quite a lot for a child, basically, who was a foster child.
Now let me ask one other question. Is it my understanding that Lewis fled to Maryland?
Yes.
The aunt is in Arizona.
Living with Jennifer, yes.
Yeah,
and the new baby.
And they can't find Lewis Ross.
They can find Lewis Ross. They know where he is.
Oh, they do. Okay.
He's been under surveillance, yes. And so it was 2 weeks before I went to California, 2 weeks before August 10th, Jennifer Campbell was interviewed by the FBI and by Lieutenant Gus Galindo of the Homicide Division of the Oakland Police Department.
And I think kudos should be extended to Detective Galindo, because he's done an extremely good job, and he's been very supportive in the investigation.
It's more than supportive. He's taken it personally because he's
right.
A father. And this case is very heartbreaking because the child was disabled, but very photogenic.
Right.
And physically, people wanted to speak to him. The child really was kept isolated because he was disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Lewis Ross was just so in love with himself that he wanted only something that was perfect like himself. So because something was imperfect, it had to be disposed of. They know that Lewis Ross planned a phony abduction, because the Oakland police are very, very overwhelmed by gang activity. Instead of reporting it to where the actual murder took place in Fremont, it was reported to Oakland police. There never was an abduction, which is a felony under California's penal code.
Okay. And Robin, saying that there never was an abduction in this case, you're basing that on police sources or just the totality of the circumstances?
No, there was the car was at first seized, the house was searched, and the cadaver dog never picked up a sign he sent that day in the gray BMW.
When you say never picked it up, never picked it up in the vehicle?
Yes.
Okay.
But there were two vehicles,
yes.
Correct, Robin?
Yes.
They had the wrong vehicle, I think.
They know that the body was disposed of in the white BMW.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a caller on the line. Let me bring them on real quick here. Caller, you're on the air. Welcome to CrimeWire.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi. Welcome. My name is Sherry Miller. I'm actually the director of the CFL Society.
Oh, thank you for calling, Sherry.
How are
What's
you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
No, I told Vito that I would try to call in this evening if I could. Basically everything that Robin has told you is accurate. When we met with, on September 10th of this year, when we met with the district attorney, Tom Rogers, it was, you know, understood by all of us that they know what happened to Asani. There's just not enough evidence. They don't have a body, they don't have a confession, and they don't have a statement. And, you know, we just try to keep his name out there and try to let people be more aware, you know, of foster situations. You know, I think that there needs to be more regulation into co-fostering when people are not married.
Also, 59 children were murdered in the state of California in 2 years in the last, in the last 2 years, because the foster care system has broken down in the state of California. And the children are generally murdered by the boyfriend who has no biological relationship to the child that's been murdered.
Robin, if you know, was there any kind of monitoring in place at the time, keeping an eye on the welfare of this child? I mean, you said that the house was clean and there was a beautiful room, but we've also heard that there were allegations of domestic violence. I mean, was anybody keeping an eye on just how this child was faring in this environment?
The social services were only monitoring his medical problems, because he was being treated at Oakland Children's Hospital. So Jennifer Campbell was diligent about bringing him in for all his medical tests and physical therapy, but there was nothing mentioned, or the social worker, I obviously was not obviously aware of any domestic violence, because Lewis Ross is an expert actor. He's very phony, he's manipulative and controlling, and very suave and very smooth, very well-spoken. So I think that he was able to hide whatever was going on. Jennifer Campbell hardly talks when he's around in the room, if you've noticed, during any of the televised interviews. She's totally intimidated by him.
Robin, this is
Robin
Gene again.
Robin
did the
and Sherry,
Maryland authorities get involved in the investigation or in any way get involved with trying to find out just what's going on with Lewis?
We had wanted to go to Maryland to put flyers and to speak to the local police precinct. The district attorney had wanted a solid case against Lewis Ross, and they felt if we went to Maryland that we would definitely be able to find someone who Lewis Ross has spoken to, especially within his family. He supposedly was an orphan and was raised by the aunt that is now currently living with Jennifer Campbell. Because they feel during such hard times, $75,000 is an amazingly large reward.
Yeah.
And we're in the process right now of trying to locate Lewis Ross. And Lieutenant Galindo is working very, very hard to try to keep him under tabs. But so far nothing has happened. And we feel that maybe the district attorney is lagging in this case because the child was African-American and was disabled, and that these are aggravating circumstances. They seem to only want to care about what happens to white, blonde, blue-eyed children.
You know, Robin, I got to stop you there only because I've been a prosecutor for so long in two different county DA's offices as well as, you know, now in a statewide capacity. And, you know, I just got to tell you, I mean, sometimes on face value, it may seem like something appears to be like, you know, they don't care about this child because of his race. But, you know, in my pretty vast experience of a prosecutor, I would really find that hard to believe. It may appear that way, but the truth is I don't think I've ever come across a district attorney that you know, makes those types of distinctions. Some cases are harder than others.
I agree.
Just because of the amount of evidence. But,
the lack of evidence. But Oakland is also under siege now. In terms of crime, it's considered number 4th next to New York.
Yeah, well, we're all under siege, unfortunately, these days.
I think the resources just aren't there to pursue the death of a small child because children have a different standing. There's two different standards for prosecuting someone who murders an adult and for someone who murders a child. There's no doubt about it, especially in corpus delicti when there's no body. Since children don't necessarily have a routine where they work, have credit cards, have a bank account, it's harder to trace their whereabouts and to trace their bodies because they're small and they decompose very, very quickly.
Yes.
Robin, can I ask you a question? Is Hassani's case, has it been entered into NamUs?
Yes.
It has? Okay.
It's been all through missing and exploited children, America's Most Wanted.
Well, I'm talking about the national database that
yes.
If it is in there. I just wonder because I looked for it today and I couldn't find it, but that, you know, I may have looked wrong.
No, it's not.
It's in missing and exploited children. It's in the global exploited children, missing children. But sometimes I think a lot of the crime, I think, databases have devoted a lot of time to the Sonny Campbell case because there are very few abductions of children in that part of Northern California.
Hey, Donna? Donna?
Yeah.
It's Vito. Let me chime in here. I've been listening to everybody here. We have a lot of people on the line tonight, so I've been just kind of laying back and listening to everything. I feel much more optimistic about this case than many of the other ones that we do here for the simple reason, you know, number one, during a press conference recently, they said that Hassani met with foul play at the hands of Lewis Ross. He's named the person of interest. They have to find, they have to deal with either the person that's the least culpable or the weakest link on this, and maybe that is Jennifer. I know we've heard a lot of talk tonight how she's in fear of this guy and she doesn't talk when he's in the room, but, you know, they're in different states now, which is good. They're separated in different states. I heard
but she's being watched by his aunt.
Well,
and
no,
the
I don't
aunt
care about
to
that.
Control her.
No, I understand what you're saying, but let me make my police point on this.
Okay.
Still, you got a new lieutenant or something, what I heard, that has a lot of good experience in this, a lot of good background in this. They will know how to play this. They will know how to work her against him eventually. Because if he killed this kid, he's no danger to her. Okay, he's going to be put away. And I realize the whole bit about, you know, people being in fear of a family or cousins or whatever may come after her. But, you know, they're going to work in whatever way they can, even if the day comes where they put a wire on her and she makes a phone call to him or something saying, the police want me to talk, what do you want me to do? I mean, it'll come to something like that. A lot of these cases we get weekly. It just seems like unbelievable. It's little hope for the families and everything else. They know this guy did it. They're just piecing it out to say, okay, let's take our time. I know it's a 6-year-old case, but let's just see. Not a 6-year-old case, but let's see 1-year-old case. But let's see how we're going to put this together. And I'm glad they know and they've made a statement. This is the guy. The two people are separated by states. So we do have a lot of advantages on this that a lot of other cases, you know, do not have. So you just got to see. This is going to be an interesting one to follow for us as the months go by, and we should keep a tab on this, Delilah and Kim, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Definitely.
You know, what I'd like to suggest is maybe getting a hold of some people in Maryland, the media and what have you, and plaster the papers with the fact that there is a $75,000 reward and the person of interest or suspect, however he's being referred, is a temporary resident of Maryland at this time. And in today's economy, $75,000 is... there's nothing to sneeze at.
Oh, I also wanted to add there's a restraining order against Lewis Ross that was filed by a woman named Angela D. In 2005 in Columbia County, Maryland.
Okay.
There is a history. He has a history of violence.
All right. Well, we're going to need to wrap this segment up. So I want to give a big thank you to our guest tonight, Jean Cervantes of Citizens Against Homicide, and Robin Weber of Citizens for the Lost. We definitely will be keeping our eye on this case, and I agree with Vito on that. I think this is a case that has a lot of things going for it that some other cases don't have. There's always hope. So I want to thank both Jean and Robin for being on, and Vito, go on.
I just want to thank Sherry Miller, too, for calling in.
Yes.
And I want to thank you on behalf of Hassani, who cannot speak for himself. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you. Vito, I think you're going to introduce our second segment tonight.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I feel like Charlie with Charlie's Angels tonight here, you know? This is great.
I'm overwhelmed, aren't you?
I hope one of yours is Kate Jackson, because she was my favorite, but that's another story. All right, we'll move on to the Brittany Phillips case here now. But, you know, again, just on that last case, I'm very optimistic, and I'd love to, you know, if you guys can keep track of that one, I think that's going to have a good ending in the sense of this guy getting finally put away, but we'll see on that. All right, Brittany Phillips. Case. Brittany Phillips was found raped and suffocated inside her Tulsa apartment in 2004. Britty, as she's called, was buried on her 19th birthday. In 2007, with a donated van, Brittany's mother, Dr. Maggie Zingman, prepared for her first road trip in an effort to catch her daughter's killer. Since then, she has driven to 33 states and 42 cities, visiting homicide units, college campuses, and sporting events like the PGA Tour, passing out the killer's information in hopes someone may provide a tip or lead. This remarkable woman is a psychologist at the Mabel Bassett Correctional Center in Tulsa, working in the area of trauma and sexual assault. And she joins us tonight. Dr. Zingman, welcome to CrimeWire. Is she there? Do we have Dr. Zingman there? Is she on the line or no?
She is not on the line. It looks like she hasn't called in yet.
Okay.
All right. Well, Vito, let me take this away then and just tell a little bit about Dr. Zingman.
Sure.
And hopefully she'll call in. Dr. Zingman, her daughter, was raped and brutally raped, I might add, and murdered back in 2004. And, you know, what was really interesting about Dr. Zingman is that, you know, this very scenario is something that she dealt with on a day-to-day basis because she was a psychologist at a correctional facility, and the persons that she dealt with were persons who were victims of rape and other trauma. So, a twist stranger than life, her life seemed to parallel the very work that she did. She got a call one day in, September 30th, to be exact, of 2004. She had a police officer, I should say, show up at her door, knocking at the door, to tell her that the very thing that she deals with on a day-to-day basis, rape and trauma, her daughter was dead, and that is what had happened to her daughter. Subsequently, this mother went on a real crusade, and I don't know if any of the listeners out there have ever seen a vehicle wrap, but she basically had her vehicle wrapped with sayings all over it that basically highlighted the murder of her daughter, and she began this caravan that you talked about, driving across state to state, thinking that, you know, this will draw attention to my daughter's case because, you know, come heck or high water, I am going to find out who did this, or at least I'm going to put the word out there, and maybe somebody knows something. And I don't know, Vito, you might know, but I think she's just done her sixth caravan to catch a killer.
Wow, I know, that is great. But what she's doing, see, our listeners need to understand how it works in many, many states out there. Connecticut, we had a case not too long ago where a fellow was murdered. They obtained some DNA at the crime scene, could not match it up initially to anybody. But what they did, since in Connecticut, as soon as somebody goes into jail, somebody is put away, their DNA is tested, the police continued like every 3 weeks to keep checking the database. Now, it did take them a year. They finally got a match. They finally lined up the guy, and he's away for 25 years now on the murder. So I believe on this case they do have DNA. And again, after reading that, I feel optimistic on that because they need to get that match. And what she's doing, I don't know, Donna, the rules in all the states, if all prisoners are getting their DNA tested. I'm not sure how that works. Maybe you have a better angle on that. But she's trying to get it out there where people are continuously tested. And if somebody raped and murdered her, there's a good chance they're going to do something else again and wind up in jail. And bingo, you have that match.
Well, you know, Vito, what's interesting about this case is what you have is an 18-year-old girl. And just so you understand a little bit about Brittany Phillips, this is a very, very brilliant child. She left home and actually left Oklahoma to go to Florida on a full scholarship. And she was studying, you know, she wanted to go into pharmaceutical research against cancer. She was the youngest one because of when she was born, the youngest one in her college class, and it was a little bit much for her. She was probably a year or two, just too young to be that far away. Her and her mother were very close. So she decided to return home and just do a few classes at the community. Well, I shouldn't say a few classes, a full schedule at the community college. But she really just wanted to be closer to home. But she was living by herself in an apartment. And, you know, her mother talked to her on Wednesday night, which was a normal routine for the two of them. And, you know, everything was fine. Mom didn't expect to talk to her. Talked to her on Monday night. Mom didn't expect to talk to her Tuesday or Wednesday because that was the bulk of her class load at the community college. But, you know, by Thursday when Mom hadn't talked to her, like I said, this is a very close relationship. Mom was a little bit miffed and called and even left a message saying, hey, you didn't call me back. But when she hadn't appeared for a couple of days of school, somebody went by and, you know, found her body in this apartment or found unusual circumstances and summoned the police. But a sexual assault in Tulsa, Oklahoma, is a very unusual thing. And, you know, you've got a circumstance where, you know, Brittany lived on a second floor. One thing the police did find is that the screens had been removed from the windows, but they didn't find any kind of forced entry to the apartment. So, you know, they have hypothesized that, you know, her murderer came in through the French doors on the second floor or through a window, but and strangled her and left her, you know, left her for 3 days. That's really an unusual circumstance, and it just makes you wonder if there was, you know, a serial murderer passing through or something of that nature. But that's the type of case where you need DNA. And that's the type of case where you need a DNA base. And yeah, Mom's crusade is basically she's arguing for DNA reform to the extent that, you know, there is DNA tests taken and included in the database from all felony arrestees, not just convicted felons, because, you know, that's where you often get a hit. You know, somebody
Right. Do you have that, Donna, you have that in your state?
we
that
don't.
Happen? You do?
Yeah, we don't.
Oh, you don't?
But, no.
I don't
we
understand.
Don't. No.
What would be the reason, Donna, why all states would not, as soon as a person is convicted, why, I mean, is this a civil liberties type of a thing? Or what's the reasoning why you just can't automatically take that DNA from the person?
Well, what you're talking is definitely a civil liberties issue, but what Mom's arguing for here is inclusion of all arrestees, and you really do end up with some constitutional issues there because you're not convicted yet.
Right.
But unfortunately, if you get a transient killer, which may well be the case in this circumstance, I mean, you've got somebody who's bold enough to come up into a second-floor apartment, probably climbing up through a balcony or a window. I mean, you've got, you know, this doesn't sound, and there's been no indication that she had, you know, any contentious relationships with boyfriends, nothing like this. This sounds like a purely opportunistic crime. And, you know, the serial murders that I've dealt with, and I've dealt with two of them, well, probably three. One, you know, we suspect was serial murder. But those people are transients, so they move from state to state to state. And, you know, they escape felony convictions, and sometimes they get arrested and they move on to the next state. You know, getting the DNA of somebody who was just arrested would be invaluable when you're
right.
dealing with, you know, that type of a character or person.
Yeah, I mean, I'm halfway okay with that part of it because, I mean, if they're not convicted, fine, you can't do it. But, I mean, this person that did this to this lady, I mean, I would bet that he must have a criminal history and will continue to do it. And that's our only hope on this, it appears, unless, God forbid, he does it again and gets caught, and we don't want it to end that way.
Well, you know, Vito, something that's really interesting about this case that has not been publicized much is that there was another attack 10 months before in that same apartment complex, two buildings over. And that has been very little publicized and certainly wasn't made known to Brittany Phillips. But, you know, it just also makes you wonder if you had somebody who was keeping an eye on that apartment complex. You know,
right.
I prosecuted a serial murderer, Coral Eugene Watts, who, you know, his very MO was to watch apartment complexes where college students or young women were known to live, and knowing at any given time, day or night, they'd be coming or going, and to target them. So knowing this was an apartment complex that was targeted towards students, and there was another attack, that attack has also never been solved. You know, it's just something you got to think about.
Well, you know, I was just out in Tulsa a few months ago. I have family out in that area, and I do know from my visits there that, I mean, Tulsa has an extremely high crime rate, number one. They have a severe problem with gangs out there, one of the worst in the entire country. So, you know, and then plus we know in Oklahoma from a lot of our cases you're dealing with an old boy network when it comes to other matters. So, you know, you're dealing with a pretty good crime-ridden area there in Tulsa. Now, what you said before about another incident in that condo complex, and, you know, the poor girl didn't know about that. Maybe that would have changed her mind to get out of that, or maybe the parents would have been able to say, hey, get out of there. You know, we didn't know this was going on in there. But it's a horrible situation.
Vito and Donna and Delilah, we do have a question in the chat room. Cassandra is asking about the other attack, that first attack. Did the women look alike, perchance? And was the other woman, was she murdered as well?
You know, I have very little information about that attack other than it was, in fact, a rape. However, I do know that, no, she was not murdered. Her appearance as compared to Brittany Phillips, that I'm not sure of. I do know it was significant enough for the police to note that perhaps they were dealing with a pattern-type incident. And another point, and this is a little bit aside, but I might just add that, you know, Brittany's mother, One thing that is a part of her crusade is she's very, very angry that subsequent to Brittany's murder, that the apartment complex itself did not make it known to other potential renters or students or young females that there had been a couple of attacks there. So that's part of her program where she's trying to bring public attention to, you know, just a number of issues, but that is one of them.
Yeah, see, in Connecticut here, one of the laws, I know because some people in my family are realtors, if you're renting a place or even selling a place to somebody, there's a certain disclosure that you has to be made to potential renters or buyers that in a place of that nature, someone maybe committed suicide or were killed in there. So I know in our state that has to be done in the complex as well as in that unit that the people are looking at, you know.
And rightfully so. I mean, if you're a student, you know, Vito, I got to say, if you're a student and there is, you know, some real security issues, you know, you should know about it.
And
you
a parent wants, and a parent is very concerned about that too. Of course,
you
got your kid, you got your kid away from home, or whatever. You got them getting their own apartment, and you know, a parent is going to check the surrounding area, see if it's a bad area. What are you dealing with here? Is it dark going into your unit? All that kind of stuff, you know.
Hey, Vito, let me tell you a very interesting story. You know, back home, God, I don't even want to say how many years ago. But let's just put it this way. I was a senior at the University of Michigan, and in the spring preceding my senior year, well, the spring into the summer, there had been two murders right around campus. One was actually a high school student at one of the high schools right off campus, and then a graduate student who worked at a restaurant on campus had been murdered over the summer. So coming back in the fall, there was a little bit of talk about something weird was going on, but, you know, it was not pronounced enough that really there was any campus-wide alert or anything of that nature. In September, the first month of the semester, another student was killed. And I should add that every one of these three women that had been murdered had been just stabbed brutally multiple times. The alarm bells went off after the third one. I just remember my senior year. It was a very strange atmosphere on campus. I was a resident advisor in the dormitory, one of the dormitories, and all the girls in my hallway were freshmen. Nobody walked anywhere at campus at night. The men in the dorm signed up if you had to go to the library or some other sort of campus activity. You'd be paired with a guy to walk there. If you got caught out after dark, all over campus there were, you know, tear-off numbers that you could call for a ride home. It was really a scary air of, you know, just terror around campus. And I do remember that year. I only risked a walk home at night one time. I was at a party that, well, got a little out of control, you know. I was 22. I wanted to go home. My girlfriends wanted to stay. And I walked home from a very dark area back to the dorm, looking over my shoulder over, you know, every 2 seconds. I would have never risked that if I had known what I found out 20 years later, because 20 years later I get a phone call. I'm a prosecutor in Wayne County, Michigan, Detroit, and it's like, what are you guys doing in Wayne County about Coral Eugene Watts? I'm like, who's Coral Eugene Watts? And it's like, well, here in Texas, it's a serial murderer. He's probably the most prolific serial murderer in the history of the United States, and he's
wow.
going to be released. So I started doing some research on the computer, and my blood went cold because the first thing that popped up was suspected of 4 murders in Ann Arbor, Michigan back in 1980, and it's like,
wow.
Oh, my God, this was the boogeyman of my senior year.
Oh, geez.
You know, never dreamed that, you know, some, well, let's see, 1980, and I prosecuted them in 2004, never dreamed that some 25 years later I would prosecute them. But before we ever get there, Texas calls and says, this guy's going to be released from prison. I'm like, he's what? And what had happened in Texas, and it's a very long story, longer than this show even has, but there had been a technicality. He had fled Michigan because the Ann Arbor police, where the university is, had got on to him. And they had been following him constantly because they suspected that he, in fact, was their man.
Right.
And they drove him out of state. He went to Texas, and, you know, within the next year before he was ever caught, he killed 13 women. And he escalated to a point where the last day that they got him, I mean, he was killing 2 and 3 in a day. In fact, the day they actually arrested him, he had killed a 21-year-old girl on her 21st birthday, 2 o'clock in the morning, and he left there, and he was in the process of killing 2 roommates, you know, a short distance away when he was apprehended.
Everything
but,
escalated,
you know,
with him a lot. Wow.
Oh, yeah, everything escalated with him, and, you know, after a long, you know, Texas called us, and like I said, it's a much longer story than I have time to tell on this program, but, you know, after a very concentrated effort in Michigan, like, let's go back to Michigan, because he was going to be released on May 8th of 2006,
right.
And there was nothing Texas can do about it, because for reasons that are too complicated to explain, the plea bargain went bad, and, you know, they came back to us. We started going through 200 cases, and, you know, tick, 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 we had like 3 years, and the clock was ticking, and, you know, the bottom line is we couldn't find anything. Through very fortuitous circumstances, my boss, the Attorney General, went on TV and he said, you know, if anybody knows anything, and a guy came out of the woodwork 25 years later, and we corroborated his story, and to wrap it all up, a long story, we prosecuted him and convicted this guy of first-degree murder here in Michigan, so he didn't get out of prison in Texas. But the point to all of this long-winded story is, you know, we had a guy who was transient here, Michigan, Ohio, across the border into Windsor, Ontario, Canada. And, you know, the types of murders he committed were the creepy type of things that, you know, we're seeing in the Brittany Phillips case, you know, slinking into a window and then he's back out. I mean, you know, the type of crime, the circumstances surrounding the crime, the Brittany Phillips crime, suggest to me a transient, a person who, you know, has targeted a person like Coyle Watts did with all of his cases. You know, I mean, it's just too brutal and too opportunistic of a crime to have been, you know, something that happened because somebody was in a rage or mad or something. I mean, this of a much more diabolical mindset, and I've seen it before, and that's the first thing that screamed out to me when I read the facts about this case.
So now, did you say, Donna, that first incident in that complex was in the papers or something? Was it out, or did people know about it?
Yeah, oh yeah, it's definitely out there. It's part of the crusade that she has. You know, Mrs. Zingman, Zingman, part of the crusade that she has is, you know, to say, hey, this isn't right. This happened in this complex,
right.
And then my daughter's murder happened, and, you know, if we had known about that, my daughter might not have been staying there.
Well, it's too bad she wasn't able to be on the show, because, you know, I applaud her great work, how she's a parent that's just, I mean, it's incredible what she's doing, how she's traveling, and she's just getting the word out, and trying to stop any of these things from happening again to anybody, you know? So, I mean, that's amazing. You know, so many people can just sit at home and just, you know, wallow in their tears, which is understandable for many, many people on cases like this. She has chosen to go out there and say, hey, you know, I'm going to, you know, find this killer, or at least I'm going to put measures in place where, you know, it's not going to happen anymore. So I
applaud her. And, you know, you're right, because it's like, you know, in this case, hey, this is a mother who is traveling in states where the murder didn't even happen, but she's well aware of the profile who probably killed her daughter, and she thinks that the more attention that I bring to this matter, the better.
Right.
And, you know, like I said, you compare it to a serial murderer like Coral Watts. I mean, she knows people like that are transient, and, you know, maybe they'll get a hit somewhere. She plans her routes very carefully.
Right. Well, what our listeners need to Go ahead.
I was going to say she plans her routes to go through states that have freeways or arteries that are direct inputs into Tulsa. So
right.
Like Coral Watts, you know, trolled all the highways in and out of Houston, Texas, and out of Michigan at one point. But she understands that, you know, if there was a hit right off this highway, even if it's not necessarily in Oklahoma, you know, this might be an area where somebody will say, wow, that sounds really familiar. That sounds similar to a case that I know of where another girl was murdered and strangled and raped, and she was on the second floor. And, you know, that's how you bring the pieces of the puzzle together.
That's right. Our listeners need to understand that this lady, this doctor, the mother saves up her vacation days at work. She uses her own money. And like you said, she plans the trips. You know, it's absolutely incredible how she just puts all that time in. And 42 cities just in 3 years. That's incredible. Incredible work that she's doing.
You know what?
And Vito, if I might bust in here for just a minute, I just want to let the listeners know that that Dr. Zingman does have a website. It's BrittanyPhillipsMurder.net. And all of this expense for the caravans that she does, like you said earlier, has to come out of her own pocket. It's not a sponsored thing. I'm sure that, you know, there are donations. But there is a donation button on the website, and I would, you know, really put it out there to the listeners. I know it's tough times, but every little bit counts. And if it takes her one more mile, it would be great. She's one of the mother heroes that I look at, like Jan Smolinski, Maggie Zingman, the mothers that are not going to rest until they get answers for their children.
Right. That's correct.
Well, and may never get them, but hopefully in this case, you know, I just have to believe what I've seen over the course of my career. I've prosecuted a number of cases that were almost 30 years old, I think four or five of them. And you know what? There's always hope that the pieces will, in fact, fall into place. And when you've got a determined mom like that, you know, that makes the odds all the better.
That is. I mean, well, you know, as we're getting near the end here, just to say tonight, you know, a lot of times it's discouraging at the end of our shows with some of these cases. Tonight, I really feel that these are two solvable cases. You know, the first one with the police really knowing who it is and just needing to cross every T and dot every I. And this one here with the DNA, and you got to get that darn match. It could happen tomorrow. It could happen 2 years from now. So, you know, these are two cases that I think we should continually follow and see the results of these.
And if I might, Vito, it's all the more likely to happen if you have DNA in the database from all arrestees, not only convicted felons, you know.
Right. No, you're right. You know, you are right. It's just something that needs to happen. I mean, nowadays, you know, even though people get away with some crimes, it's much more difficult nowadays for people than many years ago to commit a crime with the DNA. So obviously, like the case I told you in Connecticut, it took them a year, but they just kept checking. And when the bad guy got arrested again, bingo, they got him. So
there you go. Well, I think it's time to wrap up. Time's run out here. And I want to send a thank you out to the CrimeWire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Delilah Jones of our Public Relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, October 19th, 2010. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com, or hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will play automatically.
Okay, and remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Good night, and God bless from the CrimeWire team, V. Vito Colucci Jr., and tonight Vito's Angels, Donna Pendergast, Delilah Jones, and Kim Colton.
So good night. We like that.
Good night, and God bless.
The start of something big.
That's it. Show.
Good night,
HBO
everyone.
HBO movie. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Bye-bye.